Prefatory note. The following story, the first published by the author, was written 19 years ago, at a time when he was feeling his way to a method. The principles observed in its composition are, no doubt, too exclusively those in which mystery, entanglement, surprise, and moral obliquity are depended on for exciting interest. But some of the scenes, and at least one of the characters, have been deemed not unworthy of a little longer preservation. And as they could hardly be reproduced in a fragmentary form, the novel is reissued complete the more readily that it has for some considerable time been reprinted and widely circulated in America. January 1889. To the foregoing note I have only to add that, in the present edition of Desperate Remedies, apostrophe some Wessex towns and other places that are common to the scenes of several of these stories, have been called for the first time by the names under which they appear elsewhere, for the satisfaction of any reader who may care for consistency in such matters. This is the only material change. For, as it happened that certain characteristics which provoked most discussion in my latest story were present in this my first published in 1871, when there was no French name for them, it has seemed best to let them stand unaltered. T. H. H. February 1896. By the events of 30 years, 1. December and January, 1835-36, in the long, and intricately inward chain of circumstance which renders worthy of record some experiences of Cytherea Gray, Edward Springrove, and others, the first event directly influencing the issue was a Christmas visit. In the above-mentioned year, 1835, Ambrose Gray, a young architect who had just begun the practice of his profession in the Midland town of Hockbridge, to the north of Christminster, went to London to spend the Christmas holidays with a friend who lived in Bloomsbury. They had gone up to Cambridge in the same year, and, after graduating together, Huntway, the friend, had taken orders. Gray was handsome, frank, and gentle. He had a quality of thought which, exercised on homeliness, was humor, on nature, picturesqueness, on abstractions, poetry. Being, as a rule, broadcast, it was all three. Of the wickedness of the world he was too forgetful. To discover evil in a new friend is to most people only an additional experience. To him it was ever a surprise. While in London he became acquainted with a retired officer in the Navy named Bradley, who, with his wife and their daughter, lived in a street not far from Russell Square. Though they were in no more than comfortable circumstances, the captain's wife came of an ancient family whose genealogical tree was interlaced with some of the most illustrious and well-known in the kingdom. The young lady, their daughter, seemed to Gray by far the most beautiful and queenly being he had ever beheld. She was about 19 or 20, and her name was Cytherea. In truth she was not so very unlike country girls of that type of beauty, except in one respect. She was perfect in her manner and bearing, and they were not. A mere distinguishing peculiarity, by catching the eye, is often read as the pervading characteristic, and she appeared to him no less than perfection throughout, transcending her rural rivals in very nature. Gray did a thing the blissfulness of which was only eclipsed by its hazardousness. He loved her at first sight. His introductions had led him into contact with Cytherea and her parents 2 or 3 times on the first week of his arrival in London, and accident and a lover's contrivance brought them together as frequently the week following. The parents liked young Gray, and having few friends for their equals in blood were their superiors in position, he was received on very generous terms. His passion for Cytherea grew not only strong, but ineffably exalted. She, without positively encouraging him, tacitly assented to his schemes for being near her. Her father and mother seemed to have lost all confidence in nobility of birth, without money to give effect to its presence, and looked upon the budding consequence of the young people's reciprocal glances with placidity, if not actual favor. Gray's whole impassioned dream terminated in a sad and unaccountable episode. After passing through 3 weeks of sweet experience, he had arrived at the last stage, a kind of moral Gaza, before plunging into an emotional desert. The second week in January had come round, and it was necessary for the young architect to leave town. Throughout his acquaintanceship with the lady of his heart, there had been this marked peculiarity in her love. As he had delighted in his presence as a sweetheart should do, yet from first to last as he had repressed all recognition of the true nature of the thread which drew them together, blinding herself to its meaning, and only natural tendency, and appearing to dread his announcement of them. The present seemed enough for her without cumulative hope. Usually, even if love is in itself an end, it must be regarded as a beginning to be enjoyed. In spite of evasions as an obstacle, and in consequence of them as a spur, he would put the matter off no longer. It was evening. He took her into a little conservatory on the landing, and there among the evergreens, by the light of a few tiny lamps, infinitely enhancing the freshness and beauty of the leaves, he made the declaration of a love as fresh and beautiful as they. "My love, my darling, be my wife." ... She seemed like one just awakened. "Ah, we must part now." ... She faltered, in a voice of anguish. "I will write to you." ... She loosened her hand and rushed away. In a wild fever, Gray went home and watched for the next morning. Who shall express his misery and wonder when a note containing these words was put into his hand? "Goodbye, goodbye forever. As recognized lovers, something divides us eternally. Forgive me, I should have told you before, but your love was sweet. Never mention me." ... That very day, and as it seemed, to put an end to a painful condition of things, daughter and parents left London, to pay off a promised visit to a relative in a western county. No message or letter of entreaty could wring from her any explanation. She begged him not to follow her, and the most bewildering point was that her father and mother appeared, from the tone of a letter Gray received from them, as vexed and sad as he at this sudden renunciation. One thing was plain. Without admitting her reason as valid, they knew what that reason was, and did not intend to reveal it. A week from that day, Ambrose Gray left his friend Huntway's house, and saw no more of the love he mourned. From time to time his friend answered any inquiry Gray made by letter respecting her. But very poor food to a lover is intelligence of a mistress filtered through a friend. Huntway could tell nothing definitely. He said he believed there had been some prior flirtation between Cytherea and her cousin, an officer of the line, 2 or 3 years before Gray met her, which had suddenly been terminated by the cousin's departure for India, and the young lady's traveling on the continent with her parents the whole of the ensuing summer, on account of delicate health. Eventually Huntway said that circumstances had rendered Gray's attachment more hopeless still. Cytherea's mother had unexpectedly inherited a large fortune, and estates in the west of England by the rapid fall of some intervening lives. This had caused their removal from the small house in Bloomsbury, and, as it appeared, a renunciation of their old friends in that quarter. Young Gray concluded that if Cytherea had forgotten him and his love, but he could not forget her. 2. From 1843 to 1861, 8 years later, feeling lonely and depressed, a man without relatives, with many acquaintances but no friends, Ambrose Gray met a young lady of a different kind, fairly endowed with money and good gifts. As to caring very deeply for another woman after the loss of Cytherea, it was an absolute impossibility with him. With all the beautiful things of the earth, become more dear as they elude pursuit, but with some natures, utter illusion is the one special event which will make a passing love permanent forever. This second young lady and Gray were married. That he did not, first or last, love his wife as he should have done, was known to all. But few knew that his unmanageable heart could never be weaned from useless repining at the loss of its first idol. His character to some extent deteriorated, as emotional constitutions will under the long sense of disappointment at having missed their imagined destiny. And thus, though naturally of a gentle and pleasant disposition, he grew to be not so tenderly regarded by his acquaintances as it is the lot of some of those persons to be. The winning and sanguine receptivity of his early life developed by degrees a moody nervousness, and when not picturing prospects drawn from baseless hope, he was the victim of indescribable depression. The practical issue of such a condition was improvidence, originally almost an unconscious improvidence, for every debt incurred had been mentally paid off with a religious exactness from the treasures of expectation before mentioned. But as years revolved, the same course was continued from the lack of spirit sufficient for shifting out of an old groove when it has been found to lead to disaster. In the year 1861 his wife died, leaving him a widower with two children. The elder, a son named Owen, now just turned 17, was taken from school and initiated as pupil to the profession of architect in his father's office. The remaining child was a daughter, and Owen's junior by a year. Her Christian name was Cytheria, and it is easy to guess why. 3. October the 12th, 1863, we pass over 2 years in order to reach the next cardinal event of these persons' lives. The scene is still the Greys' native town of Hockbridge, but as it appeared on a Monday afternoon in the month of October. The weather was sunny and dry, but the ancient borough was to be seen wearing one of its least attractive aspects. First on account of the time. It was that stagnant hour of the 24, when the practical garishness of day, having escaped from the fresh long shadows, and enlivening newness of the morning, has not yet made any perceptible advance towards acquiring those mellow and soothing tones which grace its decline. Next, it was that stage in the progress of the week when business which, carried on under the gables of an old country place, is not devoid of a romantic sparkle, was well nigh extinguished. Lastly, the town was intentionally bent upon being attractive, by exhibiting to an influx of visitors the local talent for dramatic recitation, and provincial towns trying to be lively are the dullest of dull things. Little towns are like little children in this respect, that they interest most when they are enacting native peculiarities unconscious of beholders. Discovering themselves to be watched, they attempt to be entertaining by putting on an antic, and produce disagreeable caricatures which spoil them. The weather-stained clock face in the low church tower standing at the intersection of the three chief streets was expressing 2:30 to the town hall opposite, where the much-talked-of reading from Shakespeare was about to begin. The doors were open, and those persons who had already assembled within the building were noticing the entrance of the newcomers, silently criticizing their dress, questioning the genuineness of their teeth and hair, estimating their private means. Among these later ones came an exceptional young maiden who glowed amid the dullness like a single bright red poppy in a field of brown stubble. She wore an elegant dark jacket, lavender dress, hat with gray strings and trimmings, and gloves of a color to harmonize. She lightly walked up the side passage of the room, cast a slight glance around, and entered the seat pointed out to her. The young girl was Cytheria Gray. Her age was now about 18. During her entry, and at various times, whilst sitting in her seat and listening to the reader on the platform, her personal appearance formed an interesting subject of study for several neighboring eyes. Her face was exceedingly attractive, though artistically less perfect than her figure, which approached unusually near to the standard of faultlessness. But even this feature of hers yielded the palm to the gracefulness of her movement, which was fascinating and delightful to an extreme degree. Indeed, Motion was her speciality, whether shown on its most extended scale of bodily progression, or minutely, as in the uplifting of her eyelids, the bending of her fingers, the pouting of her lip. The carriage of her head motion within motion a glide upon a glide, was as delicate as that of a magnetic needle. And this flexibility and elasticity had never been taught her by rule, nor even been acquired by observation, but, nullo cultu, had naturally developed itself with her years. In childhood, a stone or stalk in the way, which had been the inevitable occasion of a fall to her playmates, had usually left her safe and upright on her feet after the narrowest escape by oscillations and whirls for the preservation of her balance. At mixed Christmas parties, when she numbered but 12 or 13 years, and was heartily despised on that account by lads who deemed themselves men, her apt lightness in the dance covered this incompleteness in her womanhood, and compelled the selfsame youths in spite of resolutions, to seize upon her childish figure as a partner whom they could not afford to contemn. And in later years, when the instincts of her sex had shown her this point as the best and rarest feature in her external self, she was not found wanting in attention to the cultivation of finish in its details. Her hair rested gaily upon her shoulders in curls, and was of a shining corn yellow in the high lights, deepening to a definite nut brown as each curl wound round into the shade. She had eyes of a sapphire hue, though rather darker than the gem ordinarily appears. They possessed the affectionate and liquid sparkle of loyalty and good faith as distinguishable from that harder brightness which seems to express faithfulness only to the object confronting them. But to attempt to gain a view of her, or indeed of any fascinating woman from a measured category, is as difficult as to appreciate the effect of a landscape, by exploring it at night with a lantern, or of a full chord of music, by piping the notes in succession. Nevertheless, it may readily be believed from the description here ventured, that among the many winning phases of her aspect, these were particularly striking. During pleasant doubt, when her eyes brightened stealthily, and smiled as eyes will smile, as distinctly as her lips, and in the space of a single instant expressed clearly the whole round of degrees of expectancy which lie over the wide expanse between yea and nay. During the telling of a secret, which was involuntarily Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.